You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
All together, chaps.
Hooray. Oh, no, you mean we're all together? Not you're not...
What?
What?
This is a great slick start to this week's podcast. Well, it is an off-season relaxed podcast, isn't it? We're here in London together for our Christmas dinner this evening. Early Christmas dinner, the first of the Christmas dinners, probably the last as well for us. But we had an event last night in London, the Arts Theatre in London. That was fantastic. Great fun. Cycling Podcast and friends were joined on stage by Francois Tomaso, Fran Reyes, and Matt White, the Orica Scott director. Sebastian Piquet was there as well, and Rob Hatch. And it was
And Orla Shenoui, oh God, who hosts. I mean, how Orla. Could you forget?
I enjoyed your self-review there, Rich. It was fantastic.
Well, I mean...
Said more.
No, it was fantastic fun. I didn't actually... Lionel interrupted me to say that Orla was there, and I did indeed overlook that. Sorry, Orla. Orla was the... well, we did it as a quiz, didn't we? Almost like a sort of, have I got cycling news for you? Three teams of two, and it was great fun. Unfortunately, a few of you asked whether it was recorded and will be released as a podcast. Unfortunately, it wasn't. Sorry about that. There were practical reasons for that, weren't there, Lionel?
There were. Unfortunately, we were unable to record it, so it just existed in the moment, and I think it was all the better for that.
Yeah. We will be doing more events in the new year, and might give you a bit of detail about that later in this podcast, and we'll be around the country as well. Well, we haven't had a regular podcast for a few weeks. It is the off-season. Last week we heard Orla in conversation with Ned Bolting. That was really, really enjoyable. So we haven't had the news roundup for a while, Lionel. A bit of catching up to do.
Tainted the tapas.
I should.
Since we're in a...
We are in a Spanish restaurant. I should actually also say that we did an event with Ciro Scogna Emilio last week, and that was recorded, but unfortunately there was a problem with the recording. So we'll hear a little bit of that in this week's podcast. That was going to be this week's podcast, but we'll hear a bit of that later on.
Yeah, that podcast is lost, isn't it? Mostly, unfortunately. That was supposed to be this week's podcast.
Struggling, really, aren't we?
I think not very good.
That's two things I ever mentioned that failed to record or didn't record. Not very good at podcasting, are we?
Anyway, Lionel, you did give a news roundup live then. Yeah. Can you give us a news roundup?
Yeah, I mean, this feels like ancient history now, Rich, but we haven't had a chance to mention the Track World Cup in Manchester. That was a couple of weekends ago now. Very enjoyable for anyone who was there, I'm sure. It was broadcast on the BBC as well over the weekend. Great Britain won the men's team pursuit and the women's team pursuit as well, but the story of the weekend really was the tactics of the Team KGF riders, a young team of British riders. They just missed out on a bronze medal, but performed very well in Manchester. Eleanor Barker and Katie Archibald won the women's Madison. The Germans dominated the team sprinting for both men and women, and possibly the outstanding individual performance of the weekend was Australia's Matthew Glaitzer, who broke the minute mark for the kilometre time trial, and that was the quickest time that's ever been ridden at sea level. So he was just ahead of Scotland's Callum Skinner. Rich, thought you'd be interested in that.
Yeah. Of course I am.
meanwhile, Eusebio Unzué, the boss of the Movistar team, has suggested changing the rules so that in the Grand Tours, teams can substitute riders who are ill or injured. This is in response to the reduction in rider numbers from 9 to 8, and that will come into force at the Giro, Tour and Vuelta next year. It sounds like a bit of a daft idea to me, substituting riders midway through the race, but perhaps it's his cunning plan to beat Chris Froome, start the race with Nairo Quintana, do a couple of weeks, and then bring on Mikel Landa for a big final 5 days. Can't see that catching on.
The Orica have already been doing it for a couple of years, of course, with the so-called Yates twins.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, perhaps, yeah. What would DNA testing show there? Would they have twins, different DNA? I'm straying into physiological areas that I
don't know. Very similar DNA, I think.
Very similar DNA, but they'd be distinguishable, would they? Maybe. I'm surprised somebody on the internet hasn't called for DNA testing yet. But anyway.
We had that, of course. There was a lot of talk about DNA testing in cycling after post-Operación Puerto, wasn't there, in 2006?
There was, with the blood bags and Alejandro Valverde. That was, in fact, DNA testing nabbed Valverde, didn't it? Certainly, well, they waited till he strayed over the Italian border and tested him. Anyway, that's all yesterday's doping scandal. The current doping scandal, if we can call it that, I suppose we have to call it that, the conclusion, if we can call it a conclusion, to the UCAD, the UK anti-doping inquiry into what was in the Jiffy bag that was delivered to Team Sky during the 2011 Critérium du Dauphiné. We'll talk about that, I think, a bit later on in this. It's going to be a bit of an off-season ramble, isn't it? But that story has evolved a bit more. There have been some comments from Shane Sutton as well in a BBC documentary that was broadcast over the weekend. Sticking with the legal theme, lawyers always do very well out of cycling, and Peter Sagan's lawyers will be doing quite well because he is appealing against his disqualification from the 2017 Tour de France, and the case will be heard by the Court of Arbitration for Sport on December the 6th. I can only assume that the Bora Hansgrohe team are hoping to get financial compensation here because there's no way they're going to rerun the Tour from start stage five.
Saw his brother
Paris
the other day in Mallorca. Rob Hatch and I were in Mallorca. Sagan's brother, you're right, Sagan. I mean, not.
Yeah.
You know, we quite often see cycling, so it's not that. But I remember once upon a time when I was, before I was a sort of tried
television
to be,
celebrity.
Yeah. I used to get very excited about seeing professional cyclists out on the open road, and, you know. But, yeah.
You weren't excited to see Uri Sagan
not
in Mallorca?
Not that excited.
We just completely ignored there Lionel's mischievous suggestion that the Tour de France might resume from stage six onwards.
If the Court of Arbitration for Sport rules,
who are the
Sagan's
final arbiters on sport?
If they rule in Sagan's favour, has everyone got to go back to Vittel and resume the race and perhaps
François
in February?
François Thomazot has to redo the Mineral Water Challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be up for that in February, and not in April. I don't want it to clash with the classics, but maybe rerun the 2017 Tour in February, just for Peter Sagan's benefit.
I'm not sure that will be the outcome of the CAS hearing.
Napalm, obviously, my eyes were glued to the TV watching the action from the Velodrome at the World, the cycling stadium. For the World Cup, but you mentioned the KGB's tactics. They're very innovative tactics. I'm intrigued to know what they consisted of. But you said that it was one of the main talking points. That you didn't say what was distinctive about them.
Are you trying to trip line up?
No, I'm not sure they're called the KGB, are they?
Turning the spotlight back on you, the European Championships were recently in the Velodrome in Berlin.
No, I didn't go.
Why not?
I did think about it. But then it occurred to me that I don't really like indoor cycling. I hadn't been browbeaten into going for any professional reasons, so no, I didn't fancy it.
Going back to your question about Team KGF, Daniel, not Team KGB, you said it's so disparaging, although the Soviets were very good at track cycling back in the day. So, but yeah, they're a young group of riders based at the Derby Velodrome, all teenagers or early 20s, and they've slightly mixed up how they've tackled the team pursuit. We've seen over the years Great Britain have a very fast kilo-type rider kick it off. Ed Clancy, it's been for a number of years now. But the KGF team find that the kilo rider can put the other three into the red too early, hard to get on the wheel, stay on the wheel for that initial effort. So they've got a very good kilometre rider called Jonathan Whale, who comes in and does a second turn. So they start a little bit more steadily, and then the kilo rider does, he's been doing about five and a half laps, and then he takes them up to a speed, but he doesn't necessarily then stay with the rest of the team. He drops off and leaves them with three riders to do, the last half of the race. So it's just playing with the format a little bit, and it was very effective for them.
This is one of the things, actually, although I'm not a particularly keen observer of indoor cycling, it's a bit of a theme, isn't it, that every few years someone will kind of shift the paradigm. We don't see enough of that in outdoor cycling. I mean, in sport in general, it's very exciting when someone comes along and completely rethinks something, because tactically speaking, we've had a few conversations about this in recent months. There aren't that many people, whether it be director sportifs or individual teams or individual riders, who have really completely changed or brought something completely new tactically.
You're right in the sense, because you would think with track cycling, to give it its proper title, that the that most things would have been tried and tested and discarded or adopted over the years, but things do change quite radically there, especially with gearing. You know, if you look at the sprint events, the sprint 200 meter times and the kilo as well, really when you think about Chris Hoyt, guys going much quicker than that now, and a lot of it's to do with the gearing and then the training that they're doing in order to push those huge gears that they're using.
Yeah, well, you mentioned gearing. Aqua Blue next year are going to ride with a single chain ring rather than a double chain ring. Now, I'm not really technically adept enough to explain the ins and outs of this, but that strikes me as quite a significant change in the configuration of the bike. We'll have to talk to one of their riders about what kind of impact that's going to have.
Indeed, and it means, I mean, this is something that the Aqua Blue riders will not have chosen for themselves. It's a sponsor, 3T are making the bike. It's a sponsored decision. It's a product that they're looking to market, and the riders, in a sense, are guinea pigs. And I wonder how happy or not they are about it, because it's going to be...
On the record, I think they're going to be very happy about it.
On the record, I'm sure they'll be very happy about it.
Off the record, maybe not. Who knows?
It's also not something that they can hide, or that they've got no opt-out. In the past, we might have seen, you know, teams get new sponsors, be given new kinds of equipment that certain riders aren't happy with, and they've, you know, painted up the bike with sponsors decals or whatever while using their old equipment. It's pretty obvious if someone's using one chain ring or not, isn't it?
Yeah, that's going to be a tricky one to get around, I think.
Talking of paradigm shifts, this is the time of year, of course, when teams start to get together again. They start to they go off for their first training camps of the year. Found out something very interesting last night at our fantastic event, as described
quote
by you.
Richard Moore.
Quote Richard Moore.
I was wonderful. Five stars, Richard Moore.
The Orica...
Unfair.
Orica Scott, Direct Sportif Matt White, told me that this year, for one of their training camps, that team is going to do a point-to-point training camp, or a stage training camp. So they're not going to be located in the same hotel for, I think it's about a week, and I think they're going to go from somewhere up near Calpe in Spain, not far from where Matt White lives, actually. He lives near Valencia. And I think they're going to head south, and it's going to be a bit of a stage race.
Get the panniers on.
Interesting.
Are they taking tents and stuff with them as well?
Interesting. I think they may regret that. I can see the logic in mixing it up. Training camps, you know, spending a week or 2 weeks or sometimes even longer in the same place must get a bit boring, riding the same roads all the time. I can see the logic of moving on, but logistically it makes it a lot more challenging for the staff, but also it reduces the flexibility for the riders if they've got to get a certain distance. Unless the hotels are, say, 80 kilometres apart so they can chuck in a loop, they're going to be dictated, aren't they, on the roads that they are able to ride on to a greater degree, because they've got to get from A to B.
Well, we know that Orica, the sponsors, are pulling out at the end of the year, isn't it? So maybe they're just short of money and they're going to do a runner every day. Maybe they just don't want to pay the hotel bill.
Well, he did tell us that it costs like €10,000 a week to have a whole team at a training camp. It's enormously expensive. Not sure this will cut costs, but I think a lot of teams are probably having to make quite tough decisions financially. We've seen over the last few weeks quite a lot of squads being announced that are a bit smaller than
€10,000. Is as much as that?
That's what he
said. I've always been under the impression that the room rates at that time of year are incredibly low. You know, they go to resorts where the occupancy isn't great at that time of year. Well, it's almost just to keep the hotels open.
Ticking over, yeah.
Yeah, well, at the start of this year, or was it at the end of last year, very end of last year, I went to the first of the Lotto Soudal training camps, and they, like a lot of teams, had one hotel booked, and it was more or less booked from, I think, the beginning of December to the end of January, with just a break for Christmas, and there were riders, they were all there the week I was there, the few days I was there, but some riders were staying on, some riders were going home, and then, you know, once Christmas and New Year were out of the way, there were riders who would be there the whole of January until the start of the tour, the Challenge Mallorca mini stage race. And so you'd imagine, yeah, they would get preferential rates. And I think, you know, I can see the logic in mixing it up, but we remember when Team Sky came along and did all their weather evaluation and chose Valencia, didn't they?
Yeah.
On the basis that it was the driest place in Spain or the driest place in Europe in January, and they were greeted with sort of freak wet weather. So you can't plan for everything. But I would have thought, if you're a rider, observing how the Lotto Soudal training camp went, certainly, on different days, there were different groups going out doing different things. People working on speed, people wanting to go into the climbs more, people doing, you know, shorter recovery loops, rides ranging from a couple of hours to 5 hours. Some riders even going out and doing something in the morning and then something different in the afternoon, perhaps behind a moped or behind a car. I think if you're going from place to place, well, I think it's going to backfire. So I think we already know Orica Scott are on for a shocker of a season.
And they're not going to be Orica Scott next year. We don't know what they're going to be. That's gonna, Lionel's rolling his eyes already, because it'll I at least until halfway through the Giro you'll be calling them Orica.
Well, I've only just stopped calling them Green Edge.
Yeah, well, maybe they'll go back to Green Edge, but it seems that they'll take on the name of one of Jerry Ryan's companies. Jerry Ryan basically bankrolls the team in the absence of a sponsor. It's not great news that, you know, that's their sort of parachute, isn't it? They've obviously failed to bring in another external sponsor to replace Orica. Mm.
We do know that Caleb Ewan will probably make his Tour de France debut next year.
Oh, yeah. He coaxed that
closely,
out of him.
Closely guarded secret that Matt White gave up readily last night.
We got a lot. We learned a lot from Matt White, and you'll hear some of it in a forthcoming Friends special, because Lionel and I today have been for lunch with Matt to a Japanese Peruvian restaurant in London. Very nice it was. And over 3 hours, we grilled him, or we had a conversation with him that covered really his whole career and his career as a writer and his career as a DS. And it was really, really interesting. That will be, I think, episode 2 in our Friends specials in 2018.
I already feel slightly guilty we didn't invite Daniel. Sorry about that, Daniel.
Budget didn't stretch to Daniel. I think he was busy buying a Santa outfit today. He had much more important jobs to do.
What was the cuisine? Peruvian, Japanese? Not much into fusion.
Any other off-season news?
How long is it? We're talking about shifting paradigm. How long is it before a team has no training camp or runs a remote training camp
or just does it
conducts it entirely on Swift, because Dimension Data have been doing? What does that consist of? I'm not terribly
well. I can tell you, you need a smart turbo trainer, which is one that communicates with a computer via Bluetooth, and the Zwift is like a computer game program, really, combining the data gathered from the turbo trainer, so power output, converting that into speed. You create your little avatar so that you look realistic on the bike. So I'm a sort of podgy bald bloke, unfortunately, on my avatar. And you can ride with other real people in a virtual reality world on these courses. I'm sounding incredibly fuddy-duddy-ish about this. I'm actually right at the cutting edge of cycling technology here, but I'm managing to make it sound like the presenter of Tomorrow's World explaining how a video recorder is going to work in the future. But it's a great way of indoor cycling.
Not more of that.
But stationary indoor cycling, Daniel, so you don't actually move anywhere. You must have done a few turbo sessions in your time back
I was a big fan of turbo trainer back in the day. But we have actually, we've heard various stories, haven't we, over the past couple of years about people using Zwift very effectively. Matt Heyman famously used it to prepare for Paris-Roubaix. Mark Cavendish used it a lot last year, discovered it last year. Otherwise, there have been various other training camps going on, and it's a bit of a mix of the old and the new, because AG2R, they've been off doing on a kind of outward bound sort of Krypton Factor
paintballing
type. Yeah, paint that kind of thing, which we've seen, well, going back decades, haven't we? The conventional wisdom is that a different kind of physical activity will kind of regenerate the body in various ways and regenerate the mind. But, you know, we've always seen pictures of the likes of Jacques Anquetil on cross-country skis.
Yeah, this is like fodder from 1980s and 1990s editions of Cycling Weekly, the pictures of the System U team in team issue ski jackets doing cross-country skiing.
That's a really good question. I used to love these pictures, and I remember PDM and Lavie Claire. But were they? Was it actual specialised ski clothing, or was it just a cycling kit? I thought it was just tights and thermal tops.
Tights and thermal tops, and yeah, but they
looked
like
they were
ski
using
jackets.
Their cycling kit to ski in.
Maybe.
The military sort of survival camps have died a death for the moment, haven't they?
So it's the military cycling team, unfortunately. The French army team. That's another missing from your news roundup, Lionel.
You're right.
Terrible oversight. Yeah.
But that was very 2004, wasn't it? The military survival camp with Ivan Basso flapping around in a frozen lake somewhere because he couldn't swim.
I actually attended a off-season team bonding weekend a couple of weeks ago in Germany, the women's team WNT. I was invited there by my friend Graham Hurd, who's the director, sports director of that team. It's a young, ambitious team. It's great fun, but we went go-karting. Mm. You'll hear about this in the next cycling podcast, Femina. We went go-karting, me basically, and a lot of
did you get very competitive
female riders in their
did you crash into
early
anything?
20s, quite slightly built, a lot of them.
Were there any flower pots?
Let me just say that I was quite competitive going into it, but I realized my limitations, because you definitely, weight is a disadvantage in one of those things. I would be hairy into a corner, but the acceleration just wasn't there.
So a load of 48 kilogram women that were leaving me
away from it. Absolutely, it was terrible humiliation. Anyway, I've got audio of all this, and you'll hear about that in the next cycling podcast, Femina. But, I could, as cliched as it sounds, maybe we should do this as a cycling podcast team, but you could really see the bonds forming between these riders in that context, where they were all quite competitive with each other. It was fun. It was new. It wasn't, the girls who were good at that weren't necessarily the best riders. It allowed them to form sort of new relationships in a different context. And team building does have almost a bad name, but you could really see how the mood in the camp after that session was very different to what had been before. And all night, we went for dinner, and all night they were talking about it and laughing about it, and there were things that happened. Remember that time you almost, you clipped me going into that corner, etc. You could really see that's a very effective way of gelling a group together.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. Of course, you can still get your 20% off at scienceandsport.com with the code CPAUG20. And we are very grateful to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. And also grateful to all of you who are buying Science and Sport products, because in doing so, you are sort of indirectly supporting the podcast. So thank you very much. And with winter coming and winter training, you'll need to stock up, I would imagine. In the little pause there, we decided, didn't we, the three of us, to go go-karting together at some point soon. So did we not? Maybe not. Any other?
I don't mind going go-karting, but...
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I spend enough time in a car with you over the course of the year, Richard, that...
Well, if you understand go-karting, you wouldn't be in the car with me. We'd be in different cars.
I understand that, but I also know, you get quite territorial about road space, I think, when driving at the Tour.
I do. Or one does.
Well, I was directing it at you, really, there, but in a very safe way, I would say.
Anyway, moving on. Any other off-season chat? I mean, we need to Lionel mentioned in his news roundup, couple of controversies bubbling away there. There's Team Sky stuff. There was the documentary at the weekend, which I was involved with quite closely as a consultant. That was about a 9-month project. From March onwards, I got a call from the BBC producer who commissioned that, and it was a really interesting thing to be involved with.
This was on BBC Two on Sunday evening, wasn't it? It was called
Cycling Britain Cycling Superheroes: The Price of Success? ?
That's right.
So very much a title of two halves and a film of two halves. It was a BBC Two film for a general audience. It was not Panorama. It was not an investigation. It was a very specific type of film that was the film that was imagined from the outset in that regard. And it was a film of two halves because it was for a general audience. That audience needed to know all about the successes that came really especially from the Beijing Olympics onwards, before going into some of the more recent controversial episodes concerning, well, Bradley Wiggins' TUEs, of course, the allegations of bullying at British Cycling, and the infamous Jiffy Bag story, which was, well, still unresolved, but it was certainly unresolved in the making of this programme, and the programme was finished a few weeks ago. By coincidence, UCAD reported a few days before the film was broadcast, saying, as you said, that they don't know, they cannot know what was in the Jiffy Bag, can't find out, there are no records. So it remains unresolved and you know, still hanging there, I guess. But that was a very difficult story for the film to go into because it might have been overtaken by events, and because I think none of us were too surprised that it's ended in the way that it has.
No, I think if it was possible to say definitively what had been in that Jiffy bag, you know, it would have emerged before this point. I think it was definitely odds on that they would not get to the bottom of what was in the Jiffy bag. And the more this story has kind of gone on, in a way, it obviously does matter. It would be good to know definitively what was couriered out to Team Sky at the 2011 Dauphiné, because it would help it possibly clear things up one way or the other. But really, the material facts of the case remain the same, and that is that Bradley Wiggins had tactical, strategic TUEs to treat his asthma with triamcinolone on the eve of the biggest objectives of his road racing career. And I don't think that, I mean,
what you're saying there is not what Bradley Wiggins would say. As he has said, they were for a medical need, but it was a preemptive.
It was preemptive, yeah.
Move, but yeah.
It was
It was strategic, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it was on the eve of the biggest objectives of his road racing career, when he'd, you know, after he'd made the big breakthrough with Garmin in 2009, finishing fourth in the Tour. 2010 had been a disaster. 2011, and Shane Sutton says it as clear as day in the film, Richard, doesn't he? That yes, if there's a little niggle, would we use a TUE to go from 95% to 100%. Yes, absolutely, in them days we would. I mean, that's not a verbatim quote, but that's basically what he said. And that is very much at odds with the Brailsford-Wiggins line, which is that it was purely to treat a medical need. And while we are
which
talking
is what
semantics
TUEs are
here...
For.
Which is, yes, I know. But the unfortunate and inescapable conclusion is that the TUEs were applied for because of the biggest objectives were right in front of Bradley Wiggins.
What Shane Sutton said, he was asked whether, in the context of a discussion about marginal gains, which is the mantra of British Cycling, Dave Brailsford, he was asked, could a TUE be regarded as a gain? To which he replies, well, yeah, he thinks about it, and he repeats the question, he says, yeah, it could. That's obviously the standout line from the film. What I was interested today to read some quotes from Katie Archibald, who was horrified at that, because she said that goes against... What's particularly damning about that is the melding together of marginal gains and, you know, TUEs, which are not supposed to be used as gains, but to treat a medical need. I'd like to see more riders come out and distance themselves from that idea, from the notion that a TUE could be used not for a medical need, but to find a gain.
It brings into focus the philosophical problem of this TUE issue, because the whole concept of a TUE is predicated on the basis that there is a baseline which constitutes full health, and the TUE is designed to take you back up to that baseline, that bar, and in Shane Sutton's mind, You know that was fine and that was within the rules, but he talked about it being Bradley Wiggins being 95% and getting back to 100%. You know, and you could make that argument for a legal painkiller. You could make that argument for a good night's sleep.
This is a really good point, Daniel, because I just take it away from cycling for a moment to football for this specific example, because you could have one event on one particular day, the World Cup final, say, and a player wakes up with a migraine. Would you treat that with medication? Yes, you would. You know, an athlete's worst nightmare almost is being ill, being under, you know, short of their best physically for their big objectives, and the natural desire for the medical teams and for the athlete is to do whatever they can do within the rules to ensure that they can perform at their best on that given day. And you're absolutely right. What Shane Sutton is saying is that using the system is acceptable in their eyes. The problem, going back to 2011, particularly when the granting of TUEs was done far too much on just a phone call and a form and a nod from the UCI's medical department. You know, it was too easy to gain those.
Still far too little is known about Bradley Wiggins' symptoms. I mean, nothing I've heard really suggests that Bradley Wiggins' symptoms were so bad, was so acute, or actually I think it was a chronic condition, that it necessitated such a sort of heavy duty treatment. However, the consultant and this is the person that in my mind we've not heard enough from, the consultant who did diagnose his condition deemed that they were serious enough for that drug, and from that point on they were acting within the rules. But you know, a general point about TUEs, I think the newly sworn in UCI president David Lapartient has suggested that corticosteroids or TUEs for corticosteroids will be banned from 2019. I hope that's the case, because it's a question that's too difficult to answer, whether, you know, like I say, whether you're going from 95% to 100% or from 95% to 110%.
One other bit of important detail here is, you know, from what Shane Sutton said, and if you infer from that that TUEs are part of the modus operandi almost, and from that you infer that it's part of the modus operandi at British Cycling as well as Team Sky, it is worth bearing in mind that over 6 years, Team Sky had 13 TUEs. There doesn't appear to be, worldwide in sport now, there aren't that many TUEs issued. It's harder to get a TUE. It's not like, you don't just pick up the phone or write a piece of paper and it'd be automatically granted a TUE. It might have been slightly easier to get one in the past, but the conclusion that, based on what Sutton said, that this is a really systematic, and that, you know, the whole team was using TUEs doesn't appear to be borne out by the facts.
I think the conclusion is it was systematic in Bradley Wiggins' case, and as I said, the story hasn't really changed. And I always go back to two things. One is that the TUE system should be anonymous. If it's going to exist, it has to be anonymous, because athletes' medical conditions and medical records should be subject to the same protections as any of the rest of us. And so the only reason we found out about this was because of the Fancy Bears hack, which they're basically from all we can work out, the Russians hacked into the WADA system and released this information, you know, tactically, as I assume, I'm joining the dots here, but to sort of divert away or to sort of throw some mud in the direction of certainly Britain and British athletes after all the problems that the Russian athletes had and being banned from the Olympics and so on. So without the hack, we would have been none the wiser. But having said that, had we known this information in 2012, you know, we would have looked at Bradley Wiggins' tour win in a very different light. Because think back to when Pierre Rolland, for example, had low cortisol levels and missed a couple of weeks of racing, and there were people thinking, well, is this cortisone abuse? You know, and there have been other riders that have been caught by the MPCC's cortisol rule. It cast a shadow, and I think back in 2012, the atmosphere was such that I think the scrutiny on Wiggins would have been so great that his tour win would have been greeted in entirely different circumstances.
And I think, Rich, what the documentary really did for me as well was bring into focus again the disconnect between what the British public, the uninitiated, largely British public, were thought they were being sold with Team Sky in, and what they were actually being sold. I mean, last night at our event, I talked about having this very distinct impression in 2008, 2009, 2010, when the team was kind of in its genesis and Brailsford was sort of coming to races and talking to people, that he was very much an outsider and viewed with suspicion and didn't want to be part of not only the ethics of the professional cycling scene at that time, but the sort of the bonhomie and the camaraderie and the way that travelling circus functions. You know, that maybe continued to a certain extent in 2010. And I think, you know, very quickly he became absorbed into the sort of the modus operandi and the way of thinking and the way of acting, the way of behaving that prevailed in professional cycling, and which was in flux at that time. It was becoming healthier, but it was more of a realistic, less of a romantic culture. And, you know, the documentary, it was very clear that Team Sky's raison d'etre, certainly by the end of 2010, 2011, it was no longer the sort of starting pitch that we got from Slipstream Garmin in 2008, which was, we're going to be clean and winning doesn't really matter for the moment. By the end of 2010, 2011, 2012, everything that Team Sky was saying was much more accented on winning and success rather than
100%, but
being
not
clean and transparent.
Yeah, not many people were I suppose, listening at the time, really. And I think the film did focus a lot on that period, 2010 into 2011. Failure at 2010. Some of the changes that were made going into 2011. A lot of the film was focused on that because I felt that was a very crucial period. And I think still, if you know, go back and look, and the story is told of Team Sky, the changes, the evolution, the culture over that period is very fascinating and revealing. Sorry, Lionel.
Daniel, well, I was just going to say, we know your views on indoor cycling. What do you think about indoor stationary rowing, which is Bradley Wiggins' next big objective? He's doing the indoor rowing championships, which will be held in a velodrome or at Lee Valley Park. Anyway,
I don't know much about it. I can't say I really care much about it. He's a big old boy now, isn't he? He's
big,
a big old boy.
Yeah. He's certainly put on the beef. He was at the Ruler Classic a few weeks ago. I happened to be standing with Brian Holmes, speaking to him, the Quick Step director, and he said at one point, because he's also very hirsute, he's got a big old mop of hair and a big beard, and Brian Holmes said, "Hey, have you seen Wigo? He looks like Tom Hanks in Castaway."
Whoever you are, whatever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast, as they have done all year and since last year's Tour de France. In fact, our Rafa clothing update, Lionel, Pedaleur de Charme, Pedaleuse de Charme, back online soon, I believe.
I think first week of December.
Very soon, so yeah. Just in time for Christmas.
Mm.
Perfect.
Rafa.cc. So the Pedaleur de Charme jerseys will be back. The women's Pedaleurs de Charme jerseys and t-shirts will be on sale. Check Rafa.cc. Well, when they're on sale, we'll mention it in the podcast as well.
You don't have to check. You can actually go to shop on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com, and that'll take you to the Cycling Podcast page on the Rafa website. Very nice looking stuff.
Yeah,
it is.
Richard will gift wrap your jersey in some luxury paper. Personally hand deliver it.
Uh-huh.
Possibly.
Mm-hmm. And we have some exciting news for you podcast listeners. We've been working on a book, haven't we, fellas?
We have.
A Journey Through the Cycling Year. That will be coming out next March, published by Yellow Jersey, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House. And we're very excited about it. We've been working on it all year, largely diaries from the Grand Tours with other bits and pieces, other chaps in there, some contributions by some friends of the podcast, and lots of photographs from Simon Gill as well. So it should be a really nice package.
Talking books.
Oh, yeah. That as well. But
Seamless.
Just to finish on that, when the book comes out, we'll also be doing a national tour of events. I think we're doing 6 events throughout the country. And we'll give details of where they're happening and how to get tickets in the next 2 or 3 weeks, I think. But
the country being the United Kingdom.
The United Kingdom, yeah.
Can never take that for granted, Rich.
Why not?
Well, because we're very mobile, aren't we?
Well, you think it could be Germany.
And our listeners are from everywhere, aren't they? You know, somebody listening in Australia might think, oh great,
it's truth,
they're coming
mate. They might think, they're coming to Melbourne, mate.
Oh, sorry about that, Australia. Anyway, speaking of books, as you say, Daniel, another story that's been catching everybody's eye has been the passage from Phil Guymon's book, Draft Animals, concerning Fabian Cancellara and whether or not he used a motor in his bike 2010. That's been rumoured. That was rumoured at the time. Guymon goes pretty far in saying that he believes that did happen in his book, which surprises me that got past the lawyers. It's a book that's published in America. I'm reading the book. It's a really, really good book. It's a fantastic read, and it is a humorous book. That the passage in question isn't, you know, it's, if you take it out of context, which inevitably you do, it reads like a quite quite a solid accusation, really, against Cancellara. So I'm surprised it's in there. And, you know, Cancellara's lawyers have threatened legal action, and we don't know how that will unfold.
Well, they basically issued a notice to the publishers to stop selling the book, which I don't believe has happened, has it? The book is still on sale.
Mm-hmm. It is.
I think Phil Guymon has been let down by his publishers and his editors, because I don't think that allegation, he called it an opinion, and other people have said that it was only an opinion. I don't think it really should have made it into print. It was an opinion about an objective fact. It wasn't an opinion about, you know, what he thought of Fabian Cancellara as a person, although he offered that as well. It was an opinion that he thought Fabian Cancellara had committed what is, let's face it, probably multi-million dollar fraud if he won those two races that most people, the two races that were sort of connected with the initial allegation, 2010 Tour of Flanders, 2010 Paris-Roubaix. You know, it reminded me a little bit of Lance Armstrong's lawsuit against, or Filippo Simeone, the Italian rider's lawsuit against Lance Armstrong in 2002, when Lance Armstrong called Filippo Simeone an absolute liar, and Filippo Simeone won that case, again, because it was an opinion, but it was an opinion about an objective fact, whether he was or he wasn't a liar, and Filippo Simeone won that case. So I think that Phil Guymon is on slightly shaky ground there.
I think this is a sort of social media story, isn't it? And it's a complicated one in that it transcends international boundaries. So we know that the libel laws in America are not as stringent as they are, certainly in the UK. There's a lot of people on social media who believe that Phil Guymon can say what he likes under the umbrella of freedom of speech.
And because it's an opinion that has been in the public domain for a long time.
Yeah, which may well count in his favour when it comes to defending any action, should there be any. But you're absolutely right, Daniel. It's I don't want to pick on you here, but if I say, I think Daniel Freeba's got overly curly hair, that's a perfectly valid opinion, and there's no. But if I say, I think Daniel Freeba's a thief and a liar, well, that's also an opinion. It's not one I hold, I should stress to the listeners, but that is, you're absolutely right. That's the distinction. It's an opinion pertaining to, that's also making a factual statement about you, or pertaining to make a factual statement about you.
And also the important thing is here, the source of the accusation is Phil Guymon, a former professional rider who, you know, unless he has solid evidence, shouldn't be making that accusation, because a lot of people really, and I think this is something we encounter all the time, and I've encountered it indeed in the aftermath of this film that went out on Sunday night, where people who have a certain reputation and following and a responsibility to stick to facts when they're sharing information don't, because those people have a lot of influence. And Phil Guymon is a former professional writer. People will assume that he has insight and information that he perhaps can't share. So they're taking a lot on trust there as well. And that's where. It's one thing for somebody on social media to say that without any insight, but it's something else for it to be somebody from that world.
And particularly in a world, in an age, Rich, when we're all railing against fake news and the responsibility of the media. And, you know, the media is so democratized now. Everyone has a voice. I think the print media and traditional media has to hold itself, also for commercial reasons, in order to safeguard its place in the market, its reason for being. It has to hold itself to even higher standards. And that means being absolutely 100% sure of things that are printed.
And yet, if you were to say, well, Phil Guymon shouldn't have written this in a book, you are accused, one is accused of supporting some kind of omerta, and that's not the case either. Observing the laws, or publication laws of specific countries is what journalists, authors, you know, are supposed to do. Publishers and editors are supposed to do, and it's a tricky one. But it leads to the kind of conspiracy theories as well. And this is a story we all looked at those clips put together on YouTube. Look at this. This is obvious. You know, what kind of burden of proof has been met when those videos have been put together? Because I'm not saying that Cancellara's acceleration on this stretch of cobbles does or doesn't look suspicious, but you know, has film been sped up? Has it been cut together in a certain way to give a particular weight, to lead the viewer in a particular direction? I mean, I always think when we're watching these clips put together, sometimes by credible TV companies as well. I mean, because TV covered this as well, didn't they, back in 2010. But sometimes I think it's you get into the areas of the internet where people still study the pictures of the moon landing and look at the shadows and decide that, oh, well, that definitely means it was shot in Nevada and not on the moon. And that's no way to determine the facts of a case either. This is a historical case. It's going to be a difficult one to get to the bottom of. And again, the only way I suspect that anyone will get to the bottom of it is if there is somebody who has knowledge of any wrongdoing were to come out and say, this is what we did. And that's the only way I think it could be proven one way or the other.
Yeah, not to contradict what I said earlier, but we did, this question was put to Matt White last night at the event. And yeah, again, somebody from that world and with insight, you would think. And I was quite surprised, actually, how sure he seemed that motors had been used in the past, 6 or 7 years ago, he said. I mean, the test came in before the 2010 Tour de France in Rotterdam. He thought there was absolutely no way that a rider in the World Tour could use any kind of device these days. It just couldn't happen. But he seemed pretty convinced that it may well have happened in the past, at some unspecified date in the past by unspecified riders.
Good book, otherwise?
It's an excellent book. Yeah, it really is. I mean,
the title, what's that? What's
Draft
that
Animals. I guess, I don't know.
It's a play on words, isn't it? Well, draft, double meaning. Draft as in slipstreaming, you know, draft. Yeah, and that. Draft as in, you know, draft in American sport.
Yeah, maybe. Mm. I hadn't really thought about the title too much, actually. I just started reading the book. And he writes very well, great humour, great personal insight.
We don't like cyclists to write well, though, do we?
Well,
I don't.
You don't.
No, I don't.
You
I don't. I heard someone, I think it was kind of friend of the podcast.
You think they should stick to one
thing?
Yeah,
they shouldn't be allowed. I mean, we're used to say, right, well, you were a reasonable bike rider, weren't you, Rich? But Tom Southam, the director sportive at Cannondale the other day, who was he praising? He was praising, so he was saying, by far the best writer in the...
Chris Yule Jensen is one.
By far the best writer in the peloton.
Yeah,
that made me angry.
A few contenders. We've got a couple of writers writing in our book, Daniel. You do realise that, I hope.
Heavily edited. Punctuation was over the place.
We've tied it.
Very limited vocabulary.
I kept switching tenses and all sorts.
Oh, that's a mess. Yeah, but it looks quite nice now. Yeah, Phil Guymon, also a very competent podcaster. Shouldn't say that. But
gets worse.
Bad at speed golf. Very bad speed golfer.
One can only hope so. Shall we? Well, we've got two things to hear, actually. Let's hear first a clip from our new friend special, Sunweb, which Daniel has put together painstakingly over the last few weeks. A very, very interesting listen it is, too. Let's hear a little bit of it now.
Dames en heren, over enkele ogenblikken bereiken we het station van Deventer. Hier kunt u overstappen op de trein naar Roosendaal via Zutphen Arnhem-Nijmegen van Sport 3 vertrekt tijd 11:45.
Goedemorgen, good morning. My name is Daniel Freiber. I am one third of the Cycling Podcast, along with Richard Moore and Lionel Burney. And I'm on a special assignment today, sent by Richard and Lionel to the Netherlands. I'm in a town called Deventer. You just heard me arriving there from Berlin in Germany, getting off my train. And I'm here to meet Sunweb, the team of the year, our team of the year for 2017. They had a fantastic campaign. They won the Women's Tour of Flanders with Corinne Rivera, the Giro d'Italia with Tom Dumoulin, the World Time Trial Championship with Dumoulin, and the Team Time Trial World Championship with both the men's and the women's team. They are here in Deventer having an end of 2017 meeting, pre-2018 briefing. So I'm off to meet some of the key figures in the team in just a moment. But first, it is 1 minute to 11 in the morning exactly. So that leaves me 1 minute just to creep inside the cappuccino curfew. So I'm going to get myself a coffee and then go off to meet Sunweb.
It's Ian Miltakanin going out to try to take the stage win. He's the man in the red, but he's dying on it. It's going to be Dumoulin who's going to do it. Dumoulin going to come round. Oh, it's not just about defending. Dumoulin is going to add to his lead. And it is a magnificent second stage win for Tom Dumoulin at the Giro d'Italia.
Here he comes. We're waiting to welcome our champion, and Tom Dumoulin. Oh, boy, does he deserve this. And he's still powering it in. He hasn't given up at all. He may not take the final day stage. He's got one of those in the bag already. Tom Dumoulin has done it. He has secured his first Grand Tour victory. And for my mind, it may well be the first of many. And it's going to be Sunweb. This is unbelievable. BMC giving their absolute all. The countdown happens and Sunweb explode. They've done the double here. This is unbelievable stuff.
That was Sunweb Team of the Year. I think that's what it's called, isn't it? Team of the Year, Sunweb. And it's the story of their year going back a bit further. Very, very interesting, quite in-depth in terms of certainly Dumoulin, his coaching and his different approach to this year and so on. Enjoy doing that, Daniel?
Yeah, very much so. Painstaking was, I noted,
that alluded.
Was rather, yeah, it was very loaded.
A loaded word, that.
But it's turned out like a Sistine Chapel, hasn't it?
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, just say it doesn't include anything about Dumoulin's Giro win, because it actually Daniel started making it 2 years ago. So,
oh,
daylight. It's all about the Giro win. After the Sistine
Chapel.
Say
it doesn't include anything about. Did it include anything about Phuket?
Yeah, of course.
We're very uncomfortable.
Yeah. No, it's a very, very good listen, very interesting, informative, and Daniel overcame his aversion to anything toilet related, scatological, in order to put this together, because you asked Dumoulin the difficult questions, didn't you, which for you are all about
nothing to do with doping or motors.
All about natural bodily functions. You overcame your deep unease at
I overcame the self-imposed omerta that issue.
Funny thing about that with him is that he sounds completely relaxed talking about that, doesn't he? Is that a Dutch thing? Are the Dutch very relaxed about the bodily functions?
They are relaxed about most things, Dutch guys.
An interesting story that I hadn't heard before about that incident with Tom Dumoulin. Matt White had told us that, and that will be in our friend special next year, about the Orica role, little pun there, in the Dumoulin incident. Become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. The Sunweb one is the last one of 2017, and very soon you'll be able to become a friend for 2018. Stay tuned for details. Finally today, let's hear a little bit from our show last week with Ciro, the bits that recorded, just to end the podcast on a nice, breezy, positive note. Ciro couldn't join us, unfortunately, at our event because he was at a Jamiroquai concert in Milan, which is the most Ciro thing I've ever heard. But we'll say cheerio now, and cross over back over to Rafa in Spitalfields last week, where we were joined by Ciro. But that's all from us just now. Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, chaps.
Thanks for this warm welcome, first of all. And sorry, as usual, for my English. I should study English, Richard. This is the problem. But the problem is that now I'm studying Portuguese, and really I don't know why. Because it's not really useful for me. But
perhaps you could use this as an opportunity to perhaps get some beach shorts made by Rafa for your next holiday.
This could be also an idea for me, but also an idea for Rafa. Why not? I'm certainly, you know, fortunately, I spend a lot of days to the beach, so it could be a good publicity for them, not for me, because I don't need publicity, you know. I'm already maybe famous, really famous. So. The question is, this story has really affected the Bradley Wiggins reputation in Great Britain or not? It's not. I don't know if it's easy to answer to this question, but in my opinion, it's also important because comparing, for example, with Froome, I have always the impression that Bradley Wiggins, from British people, has always been considered, in a certain way, more British than Froome. Do you know what I mean? I mean, Froome, we know the story. I mean, he was born in Nairobi, and then he grew up in South Africa. Certainly, he's English, he's British. I mean, his victories are for Great Britain. But in my opinion, I have always the impression that Bradley Wiggins was the real hero for, for the tifosi, I mean, of the United Kingdom. And so, the question is, this story has affected his reputation or not? Because I read his statement yesterday, he talked about a living hell, and so...
Well, I certainly think for some people it hasn't damaged his reputation at all. For other people, it has. He's been doing a lot of rowing, Ciro, so maybe you need to ask the rowing podcast.
Why not exactly? But I mean, in this case, especially in this case, certainly also after the statement of the UK anti-doping agency, maybe there is still the impression that something unclear has happened. I have this sensation at the end of this story for the moment.
Why is it appealing to the Giro, to RCS, to go to Israel?
I mean, first of all, certainly it's a commercial reasons are important, I mean, certainly. And it's a kind of tendency also of the other big races. For example, the Tour de France, in the last editions, every 2 years, almost there is a grand départ, a grandstand abroad from France. And also Tour of Italy is doing the same. Also, maybe the will to be, you know, with the Tour and Giro, there is also competition. There is the competition to be the first to do something. And so this is a kind of a first start of a grand tour outside the Europe. And I think also this reason has been important for the Giro, I mean, to try to do something historical.
And are they aware that there's a controversial aspect to taking the race to Israel because of the, it's not... You know, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, sport and politics not mixing, but, you know, that kind of gets ripped up when it suits. So I guess it's the same situation here. If the money talks, then the race will go there.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there is also the organization did several trips to Israel to control the parkour, to talk with authorities, and they are confident that the situation will be in a certain way good without any problems. I mean, and they are also, they know that Israel is one of the country maybe most used to organize security. So also for this reason, they are confident. We have to consider that now in this moment, I have the impression that cycling is more popular here than in Italy. This is my impression, I mean, certainly because, we know, I remember 3 years ago, the start of the Tour de France from Leeds and Sheffield. I mean, I never saw a huge crowd like this, not even in the Alpe d'Huez. So now, so the moment of cycling in Italy is not really easy. For example, we have a big champion as Vincenzo Nibali, certainly is a champion, but maybe it's not really... Do you know what I mean? It's not really, for him, popularity is not very important. So it's not really well known, in my opinion, outside the edge of cycling. So also for this reason, cycling needs other athletes, other important athletes in Italy. So I don't think that the fact that Italy doesn't go to the Worlds will give necessarily much more spaces to cycling. Certainly, if Nibali, for example, if he participates to the next Tour de France and he will be in the fight for the yellow jersey, this could be something big for Italy. This is for sure. I have the impression that, for example, some years ago, Bresford talked about the 2020 vision. I mean, so their goal is to arrive. But I have the impression that Sky is thinking about a future also beyond the 2020, because they, on the market, they signed a lot of really young riders. They signed Egan Bernal, it's not English, only 20. They signed Sivakov, not English, more or less 20. They signed also the Danish rider, if I'm not wrong, Alvorsen, if I'm not wrong, that he was
Swedish?
No, it's, I don't know if it's Alex from from Danish or from Norway, something like that.
Norway, Sweden, or Denmark.
Something like that. So they are not English, but if you sign riders so young, I have the impression that they see a future for them in cycling only beyond 2020. I have this impression.
There aren't many teams that have the luxury Sky have, where they can go and cherry pick the best of this year's kind of under 23 graduates. I mean, Bernal's not even an under 23 graduate yet. He's still only 20, he'll be 21 next season. But they also have the luxury of knowing that if somebody develops in the meantime with another team, they've got the budget to pretty much blow anyone out of the water. And we've seen it with Kwiatkowski, you know, a world champion, monuments winner, you know, in a subservient role in the Grand Tours. You know, he would be a bona fide leader in, you know, another sort of dozen other teams. So Sky have got the best of both worlds there, simply because they have so much purchasing power.
I think that also philosophy of Sky is a little bit changing in this year, because if you remember, certainly when they entered in cycling, they say, okay, we want to win the tour in a few years with a British rider, okay. But now also their philosophy is not only any longer only about the tour, because they won the Liège-Bastogne-Liège with Pols, the Milan-San Remo with Kwiatkowski, now the Vuelta with Froome, and they also in this year they also trying to win the Giro. For the moment they didn't were able to, but who knows next year. So also their philosophy is changing. In the last days I talked with some people from Team Sky, and I had the impression that in this moment they considered Dumoulin as the main rival for the Tour de France. In this moment the real threat for them, more than Quintana, is Dumoulin. I had this clear impression, I mean, inside the Team Sky. So, and I mean, he's certainly a real treat. I mean, he's only 27 now, so really complete. As you said, also the Giro of this year was really tough, and he was able in Europa. I mean, Europa is a really tough climb, and he was able to overtake everyone. So, yes, in my opinion, they consider him as the real threat for the Tour.
Well, Quintana's only doing the first week, and then Landa's coming in, and then Valverde's doing the last week. So,
exactly. Imagine that I was 2 or 3 days ago interviewing Gianni Moscon at his home. And yes, it's not possible to ignore it that he had really a controversial season. I mean, from the good part of this season, really a really complete rider, because he was labeled only 23, two top five in two monuments, so different as Roubaix and Lombardy. A great Vuelta with Froome, but also he arrived sixth in the World Championships as time trial. But also, I mean, we can say a dark part of his season. I mean, the racial accusation of Reza, I mean, the Tau at the Worlds, and this accusation of Reichenbach. This last episode in Trevali-Varesina is not clear for the moment, because at the end, Reichenbach immediately said that he wanted to denounce him. But for the moment in Italy, I 2 or 3 days ago, I did a check, but for the moment, no formal accusation has been done from Reichenbach for the moment against Moscon. So really controversial. Certainly, he's certainly strong, but at same point, I think that he knows that he has to change a little bit his attitude in the peloton. But for sure, we were talking about Team Sky. He has a contract already till 2019, but I know that there are talks because Sky wants to have a longer contract with him. So I have the impression that we had also in the future will have the possibility to talk about Gianni. We hope only for good things. I'm not able to explain really well because unfortunately my English is still not perfect, but really, Lionel, since when we started this podcast experience, my life has changed. And so these evenings are part of the best part of my life. See,
it's been nearly 5 years, Ciro. So, yeah, we'll have a party, won't we, at the tour next year to mark that?
Yes, with some of these friends, I hope. We, you know, July, France, Tour de France. I mean, it's a good occasion. Why not? We wait for you.
Thank you, Ciro.
Thank you.